All right. Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Don Bishop. I write fantasy as T.S. Pedramon. And here we are today with author Laura Nelson. And Laura, we had a conversation last week, which will come out in the future. So listeners, as you listen to this episode, today as we record, it is December 12th, 2023. And Merry Christmas, by the way, because I'm planning for this episode to come out on Christmas Day. So Merry Christmas to everybody out there in internet land. And our conversation from last week was more about the author journey. We never really got around to the topic that we intended. So we bring you that topic today. And last week's episode will release in January. I'm looking at probably, I'm looking for what date I pushed it to, and I'm not seeing that right now. It actually, that conversation might come out in February. Anyway, we'll figure that out. if you want to hear more from author Laura Nelson, then check us in again in the new year, and you'll hear us have another conversation that we had last week. For now, so Laura, you write some historical fantasy, and you write Norse fantasy. And I think there are a lot of ways, and I'm looking at the notes from the email here. I think there are a lot of ways that that could go. So why don't you tell us what these two things are, what they encompass? So historical fantasy, I mean, maybe like Pride and Prejudice and zombies, although that would be more like, no, that's not historical. That'd be Regency horror.
Yeah. So historical fantasy, it's a subgenre of historical fiction, which in and of itself is like a literary genre. And generally speaking, with historical fiction, you're dealing with actual like things that happened. So I'm trying to think. Technically, Pride and Prejudice nowadays would be considered historical, like kind of historical, but at that time it would have been like contemporary.
Historical fiction then, because it takes place in a historical era.
Yeah. So for Jane Austen writing Pride and Prejudice, it was contemporary for her, but it's historical for us. Actually, a really good example of a famous piece of historical fiction is A Knight in King Arthur's Court, or A Yankee in King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain, because that was, and that's actually a time travel kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
But that is, I want to say, A Yankee in King Arthur's Court is considered to be what?
A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Connecticut Yankee, yes. Is considered to be one of the first actually published pieces of historical fiction that we know of. And so at least that is categorized as historical fiction, because you have the main character who gets tossed back into the past, into King Arthur's court, into medieval England. So yeah, that's a fun fact about historical fiction.
I would point out, in case this story pops in anybody else's mind, that's different from Don Quixote, Quixote was contemporary, but the main character wished he were back in historic times, and even wished he were in historic fantasy times, because he tried to fight a giant, you know?
Yeah. So Don Quixote would be different. Would be different just because it took place in the author's contemporary period.
Yeah.
As opposed to a pastime. I'm trying to think of other famous, Outlander, for people who like their time travel romances. Outlander is considered a historical is considered historical fiction.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go ahead and toss yours in the mix? Because you have a book. Is tomorrow's book historical fantasy?
Yes, absolutely.
Because you have a book coming out tomorrow on December 26th.
Correct.
Tomorrow, episode is released.
Yep. So Priestess of Herculaneum is also a historical fantasy. The main character is a museum archivist in Washington, D.C., and she goes to an art exhibit at a unnamed museum on the mall. But you can kind of, if you are familiar with the museums in downtown D.C., you will see where I get my inspiration from. But she goes to an art exhibit, and while she's there, she ends up being tossed into the past, into Herculaneum, which is a town near Pompeii, in the year 79 AD, right before Vesuvius is to erupt. And when she arrives there, at first she's like, this can't be real. This is all in my head. But it's not. It's not in her head. It's completely real. As are all of the mythology, all the gods and goddesses of Greek and Roman, they're all real. They're just not the way that the stories talked about them. And so the main character, Alex, is now in Herculaneum, and she's visited by the muse of history, Cleo, who tells her that she is here to save someone. And in order to get back home, she needs to save this guy. And that is the story. I won't give away too many spoilers. People can read it tomorrow. That's kind of the premise, is that she got tossed back into the past. She has to save the day, or at least one person's day, and then hopefully get home.
Okay. So how do you approach world building for that? And I know you mentioned, World Anvil, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you approach it?
So with historical fantasy, I do have to kind of base things in a little bit of reality, because this history has existed. Like, people know about the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. They know about, you know, stuff about ancient Roman culture, that kind of stuff. However, especially with ancient history, there's a lot that we can speculate about, but we don't actually have records of. And so both with that, and then also the concept of time travel, that is sometimes people will say time travel is science fiction. Some people say it's fantasy. Some say it's both. I'm kind of in the both category.
Depends how it is accomplished.
Exactly.
And science fiction is a subset of fantasy anyway. I know those are fighting words, but that's my stance. The difference is aesthetic.
Yeah. So generally speaking, if time travel is created through some form of magic, so like in Outlander, she touches the stones and she gets tossed back into the past. In my story, it is the muse Cleo who tosses her back into the past. That would fall more into the fantasy realm, whereas time travel, like, I am now blanking on the name of the movie. Back to the Future.
Mm.
Back to the Future. They time travel because of a plutonium fueled car, which is absolutely science fiction. I have a theory that Back to the Future is actually historical fiction as well, because not only does it start in 1985, and then even when they go to the future, it's 2015, which is the past now. But then they also go back to, I want to say, 1885 in one of the movies. So yes, Back to the Future, the whole series is historical fiction. As uncomfortable as that might make some people.
I would say Back to the Future 2 would be, the time period
is historical now. Well, that was to 1955.
But when it was created, it was in the future. The 2015 was in the future.
Yeah.
So I would say that.
But the two.
You don't have future historical fantasy as a genre. But anyway, sorry.
Well,
go on.
Yeah. Like I said, I will debate that Back to the Future is historical science fiction. And so, but that's the point was, is that in Back to the Future, they use a car, they use technology to move back and forth through time. Whereas in stories like Outlander or even My Story, it's more of a magic-based travel. And
something's
so,
itching, and this is off topic, but there's something itching my mind that there's a story of somebody who had a watch that let them time travel. Do you know? I'm not.
That sounds
what
familiar.
It was.
Anyway, is it the? Okay. I feel like it was an H.G. Wells story.
I mean, H.G. Wells did write the. Did he call it Time Traveler? He wrote that story, but it's
yeah.
a device. It's a machine that he sits in, so that's not a watch.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm thinking of Clock Stoppers, where it slows down time. That's a movie.
Yeah.
Directed by Jonathan Frakes, but yeah,
okay,
kind of a fun movie. Not time travel, just
another,
time dilation.
Another good reference for like different ways that time travel is done, and it's kind of scientific, like the science fiction aspect of it, is the TV show Timeless, because they use, once again, I would highly recommend it. It's a good show. But they use, I want to say, machines. I don't know if it's necessarily like airplanes or not airplanes, but like flying. It's not a rocket ship. It's, I need to go and rewatch the show, but
it's a
it's
DeLorean.
Not like a car or a, it's not a DeLorean.
Not
no.
A car.
But yeah, Timeless is another good example of how time travel can be shown in sort of a science fiction element. But yeah, I like the fantasy element, because I like being able to kind of play around a little bit more with how the time travel works, that it could be more magical as opposed to plutonium.
What's tomorrow's book called again?
Priestess of Herculaneum.
Okay. And so the main character, is she from our time and she gets thrown back?
Yes. Yeah. So the story starts in 2009. And she is Washington, D.C. Every day's, you know, it's a normal day.
Oh, that's right. You said a museum.
Yep. And so then, yeah, it starts in March of 2009. So when she gets tossed back in time, she then goes to end of July in 79. So she goes from wearing like being in the winter to being in the heat of the summer. And so there's a funny scene about her having to adjust to that and being like, yeah, why is it so hot here? Because you got tossed back.
Yeah. And it's worse if you're not, like, you can be there in the middle of July and you're like, man, it's hot. But if you weren't acclimated to it, it'd be even worse. Like,
mm-hmm. And that's actually something that I had to build in my world building into, is figuring out what the temperatures, what the climate, all that kind of stuff would have been compared, like Washington, D.C. in March versus the Gulf of Naples in July, August time period. And how would someone adapt to that? Even though we do have kind of, we have buildings and we can see how stuff was laid out, there's a lot of stuff in that we don't have records about, of like daily life. So we can assume the kind of clothing that people wore, how they kept themselves cool, because when I was researching it, Herculaneum, Pompeii, that whole area during the summer is actually very similar. It's a Mediterranean climate, very similar to Southern California, which means in the summer, even if you have like coastal breezes, even if you have cool air coming off of the water, it's still going to be a very hot place. And so
I would have to do a little bit of historical research.
What?
Oh, sorry. I think we have some kind of delay. What kind of temperatures are we talking about?
So I want to say the average temperature in like the Gulf of Naples, like during the summer, is in the high 90s.
Okay.
Fahrenheit. So, yeah. And they'll sometimes, depending on, you know, depending on the day, will hit even triple digits. And so I would say, like, if you've ever been to the coast of California, Southern California, in the middle of the summer, not the desert area, but more of the coastal side, that's probably that's the easiest equivalent I can make. Or if you've been to the American South, where it's super humid, because that's the other thing is that because places like Herculaneum and Pompeii were very close to the Gulf, the Bay of Naples, it'd be very humid.
Yeah. And I've spent several years in San Diego, in the San Diego area. and now I'm an hour south of DC, you know, give or take whatever, but it's definitely a lot more humid here. And I believe it gets hotter here. It definitely, gets hotter sooner and stays hotter longer.
Yeah.
Cause in San Diego, you have those Pacific waters coming down from Alaska that keep it from getting too hot.
I want to say is cooler longer than the Atlantic.
Yeah.
So you have to adjust for that kind of stuff in world building. Like, how are people living in these places without air conditioning, without things to keep them from sweating to death or dealing with the humidity? And while we can guess how people might have done that, we don't actually have a lot of records as to how people kept from being all sweaty and stinky and all that kind of stuff during the time. And so that's where some world building comes in, is basically to kind of patch in where we don't have specific information as to how people would have lived.
Pardon me, just finishing my chamomile.
Another element of world building, because this is fantasy and I'm using a background of the gods and goddesses, the muses, those all being real individuals, I have to basically create sort of the background of what causes them to be these supernatural entities. Now I don't treat them as though they are actual gods and goddesses in my series. Rather, I have that they are immortals. And so they are humans who have the ability to not age past a certain point. And so then I have to do research and world building as to how would that work? How does that work on a biological level? How does that work on a mental, emotional level when you're living in a place and you hit a certain age and everyone else keeps getting older, but you don't? How do you adapt to that? And so
I think it depends on the personality. Mm-hmm. Some people would. I mean, did you see the movie Jumper?
Yeah.
Some people would just be all about number one and like that. But some people would be like, well, you know, I'm set. I'm taken care of. Who else can I take care of?
Yeah. And I do play, and that's, once again, this is, so world building isn't just about like geography and culture and that kind of stuff, but it's also about building like an inner world for the characters. How are they going to react to the rest of the world? How are you going to have cultures that know about, say you have people who know about immortality. There's mm-hmm. going to be little subcultures that grow up within the bigger culture. What is their world building? What is their world like? So
yeah,
even though there's a lot of historical fantasy which involves research of real subjects, of real, like real things that have happened in the past, there's also a lot of world building because you're bringing in that fantastical element of, say, time travel, immortals, these fantastical myths that we've heard of, but we're like, oh, those are just myths from the past. That didn't happen. That wasn't real. What if they were? How does that all fit? How does the fantastical fit in with what we in our world know is real?
So do you grab an element of folklore and then pull the thread and see where it leads you?
Yeah, a lot of times I do. Yeah. I will read a story where I'm just like, oh, this sounds really cool. And I'll be reading about it. It's like, oh, well, this people, you know, scientists and archaeologists and scholars believe that this person was a mythic person and they didn't really exist and they're just an amalgamation of real people, da 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 da. I'm like, what if they were? What if they were a real person? Or even like with different deities from different cultures. What if these were real individuals? And how are they interacting with other deities from other cultures? So I've had people ask me whether or not there's any Norse gods and goddesses in my historical fantasy. I'm like, they technically exist. Thor exists within the historical fantasy world, even if he isn't mentioned in the books. He exists. Uh-huh. So it's like, what happens if, you know, Thor goes to meet Mars, goes to meet, you know, Ares? How are these characters going to react to each other?
Have you gotten into Orson Scott Card's Danny North saga, the Gatefather?
I have not.
Series.
Mm-mm.
The okay, let me be careful not to spoil anything. It's pretty good. I listened to the audiobooks, but the premise there, and it's set in modern times. But the premise is that you have all these mythologies from ancient history. And well, they're real, except that the names that have been passed down for these different deities are titles, and and they're not immortal either. So like in the North family who immigrated from Northern Europe, the North family, it's kind of they live on a compound, kind of a compound for their family. And they're all mages, basically. And the most powerful fire mage in the North family is Thor.
Okay.
Like the title, he receives the title
is Thor.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, Loki the trickster, he was a gate mage, and that's the title for the, yeah. And so you have like
for the most powerful
Ares,
gate mage.
Ares was the gate mage from the it's not the Greeks. It's who the Greeks actually took their deities from.
Macedonia, but yeah, Mycenaean.
But anyway, so that's kind of the gist of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a cool concept.
Yeah, I'll have to check out that series.
Here I am.
But
accidentally representing for other authors of my faith.
Well, Yeah.
Shall we throw out Brandon Sanderson?
I have no problem with that. Because I'm LDS as well, and so
yeah.
I like, I've read some of Orson Scott Card stuff. I've read some of Brandon Sanderson stuff. And I will say this, actually growing up, I grew up reading a lot of LDS fantasy literature, and a lot of that has inspired me. So not to get into the author's journey again, but a lot of their world building has inspired my own world building, and how I'm kind of imagining, oh, what if it was like this? So
yeah.
I'll have to check that series out.
Yeah, it's good.
But yeah, there is a lot of world building that I've had to do with, like I said, with the historical fantasy, piecing together stuff that like, or patching, putting in possible explanations with stuff that we don't know about the cultures, or stuff that, if this mythic story happened, what was it really like? That kind of stuff.
So forgive me if I have kind of a reductionist tendency, but to put it in a nutshell, to reduce it, if you will. So when you do your, you do Norse fantasy and you do historical fantasy, would it be accurate, or would you say that your kind of angle is to write stories involving ancient folklore, magic, or deities? Is that where the sources that you draw on for your stories?
A little bit. So the Norse fantasy is more pure. I don't want to say pure fantasy, but it is more like epic fantasy. You're not going to find the Norse gods in my Norse fantasy world.
Uh-huh.
It is a completely different world that is separate from ours. And the only way that you can connect the two is through dragon magic, which our world doesn't really know about or acknowledge.
But you got to have dragons.
You got to have dragons. So my Norse fantasy has lots of dragons. They are considered to be very powerful deity-like creatures. But they do not, when they do come to our world in my Norse fantasy series, they don't look like dragons. They're just kind of non-corporeal. They don't have bodies. They're more, I don't say spirits, but they're mistaken for wind and clouds and that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And so unless you have that, have a connection to the world of Loishara, you would just think that it's a big storm when they're swarming around. And they also are less sentient in our world than they are in their world. But I don't know if you're curious about that. That's another bit of world building. That's more in my Norse fantasy. But yeah, I would say that I do try to take some inspiration from the myths and the lore that we have in our world, and kind of I like to do what ifs. What if the lore, what if the mythology, what if these stories were actually like this, like something else? So
do you ever throw the different cultures' lore in a blender?
A little bit.
And I would say
in what way? I'm curious.
Well, in Orson Scott Card's Gatefather series, it's not quite like that. It's more like he homogenized the magic, but then spread it out across cultures. So like each family has a fire mage or a gate mage or a whatever, and it's the same. There are only so many different types of mages. And over here, they call him Thor. Over here, they call him Hephaestus or whatever.
Hephaestus. Okay. Yeah.
And sure, there's a different culture among the Norse people.
It's different names.
Yes. So there's that. Or you can say, here's this story that Loki turned into a horse with six legs. So that's something Loki can do. There's no such thing as that in Greek folklore, although Zeus turned himself into a bird and I don't know.
Yeah. So what I do like to do is I'll research and sometimes find more of the obscure stories that aren't so commonly known and be like, how are these similar? And so so if you have a character, so with my historical fantasy, you have Apollo who has a lot of connections to healing and the arts and daylight and all that kind of stuff. And you have similar deities in Roman mythology. And so while I say that they are not the same, so Zeus and Jupiter are not the same individual. Apollo is not the same as the solar gods in Roman mythology, or even I want to say, so one of the characters I have is Janus, who
What about Hercules and Heracles?
So with some of the characters, they are the same individual. So Poseidon and Neptune are the same person. They just have different names in different cultures because the culture was like, oh, you, that's what we're going to call you. But so like with Poseidon and Neptune in my world, his actual name is something completely different. But the Greeks were like, we're going to call you Poseidon. And he's like, all right, I'll run with that. And then the Romans are like, we're going to call you Neptune. He's like, okay, I'm going to run with that. Because he's not natively from Greece or Italy. He's from a different place entirely. And so you will have some people like Hercules who, is part of the lore in my historical fantasy where, it's the same person, especially if they've been if their stories, especially of them traveling between place and place, they're going to be known by different names or similar names. But you're also going to have individuals who have the same powers and they are more local. So like Jupiter, he's like, my turf is Italy. This is where my power is and where I, people believe in me and where, this is my turf. And he's not going to go over to Greece and be like, now I'm going to start playing in Greece and trying to be all tough over there. He's like, I've got my place. And then Zeus has his turf in Greece. And so sometimes they'll blend, but then you also have immortals who are just like, this is my turf. This is my area. And, no one messes with it. So just like people.
In Priestess of Herculaneum, what would what is there any other author's work that you would say that it's kind of like that or influenced by that that the listeners might be familiar with?
So I like to say that Priestess of Herculaneum is a blend of Outlander, Doctor Who, and Percy Jackson. I'm also in some ways, it's also like A Wrinkle in Time with just the way that the characters are. Because The Wrinkle in Time, that whole series was something that I loved reading as a kid. And that actually inspired a lot of my stories.
So do you have any moral underpinnings? And I'm not, so nobody's confused, I'm not trying to say like, are you trying to teach us a lesson? No, like A Wrinkle in Time had moral underpinnings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have any like that? Or is it more like, I have not read Percy Jackson. I distractedly saw the first movie. Is there more than one movie? But
so I want to say the Percy Jackson, I want to say there's two movies, but the two movies that came out, anyone who has read the Percy Jackson series, do not claim those two movies. They do not like those two movies. They're like, this is horrible. We don't talk about that.
Yeah. So I'm saying like the themes were contrasting with A Wrinkle in Time is the perception I get.
Mm-hmm.
Where A Wrinkle in Time tied everything to a base morality where the there was this evil it that wanted to control everything.
Yeah.
Sorry if that's a spoiler, but the book's been out for decades.
Exactly, yeah. And there's some in the movie. There's been, yeah.
Yeah, and they say that people fighting against the it, fighting against this influence that only wants to control and enslave, wearing the face of order and discipline.
Yeah.
People fighting against that included, and it even names Jesus Christ as somebody who fought against that mm-hmm. being or influence. So I'm kind of meandering and mumbling, but so that's one thing where very strong, very close tied moral underpinnings of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Percy Jackson, I think it's oh, here's an obvious problem. We should try to fix that problem because this person is doing something that's obviously bad. So let's stop them. You know, a very, very classic manner to set up a story.
So Madeleine L'Engle, a lot of her works are very much based in Christian theology. I can't remember what her religion was. I want to say Catholicism, but I could be wrong. But yeah, she's very ardently a Christian, much like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. And a lot of their works, there is that base underpinning of good versus evil, and certain things are good and certain things are evil. Whereas you have a lot of more modern authors, like you said, who don't have such a heavy emphasis on a moral underpinning. My stories, if there is a moral underpinning, it was not intentional. It is more of, I like to write what I see as a good story, a story that I enjoy. And I mean, there are certain basic, you know, right versus wrong elements, but I think that those elements are more universal than coded to just like one religion or one religious belief.
But is this going to be like, if they are there, I didn't mean them. Is it going to be like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where, the author said he didn't intend to like build any allegory with it. He was just telling a story, but like I'm like, wow, you know, that's a strong allegory of Jesus Christ, where the spoilers. Anyway, the book's been out for decades. Even the movie has been out for almost two decades. So, Aslan sacrifices himself, and by the means of his sacrifice, he breaks the evil entity's power, and then he comes back to life too. Like, so for me, that was
a very clear allegory.
Even if it was unintended,
there's a lot of allegory. There's a lot of Christian symbolism in C.S. Lewis's work. So, if for him, if he's saying that it wasn't intentional, then it may just be that is like how he sees how he saw the world. He's not alive anymore.
Yeah.
But you know, it may be the way he perceived the world was just very strongly through that lens. And so for him, he didn't see like he didn't think that it was him just telling. He thought he was just telling a story.
Yeah. Well, and so. I think I think even if you don't intend to do it, you could very possibly see it coming out and realize that that's what's happening. But that's just how the story is coming together.
Yeah.
And like I wrote my Nightshade Unicorn book that I've been talking about for a few months, and I wrote it. It exists. It's going through editing right now, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Not full swing yet, but it is. And I'm gonna publish it end of February. But the protagonist needed to be called upon to help avert some great disaster, right? And how do I construct that so that it becomes necessary that this protagonist goes on and does this quest? I decided that she has qualifications in her personality, and these aren't really spoilers. Nobody's read the book except my 12-year-old daughter yet. Nobody's read it, but the protagonist had to be somebody with certain qualities, which are moral qualities. And I'm not trying to teach the reader a lesson and say that, hey, you need to learn to live this way. That's just, this character is this way, and that's why she's suited for this job. So
I'm very much the same way with my stories. So my characters in some of my stories, they're not going to make the same life choices that I would, but they're the life choices that make sense for that character. And so like with my Norse fantasy, it's young adult. The characters are, 17, 18, 19 years old. And during the series, the main character gets married to her romantic interest. I am not advocating for 18-year-olds to get married. But, I mean, if you got tossed into a world full of dragons and you're having to fight and, you're dealing with magic and all this kind of stuff, well, I guess maybe, if the situation calls for it. Because after she gets married, she becomes queen. So, I mean, but I'm not advocating for people to, get married when they're 18.
I think our culture is a little funny about wanting to marry older.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to marry younger than I did. But I wasn't going to force it when it wasn't the right time.
Yeah.
Wasn't the right person, whatever. And I got married shortly before I turned 25. So most of Western culture today would say I got married pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
I had a brother who got married at 22.
Yeah.
And I think our Western culture is kind of funny about thinking that you have to be grown up and well settled. Like it's a journey you go on together. And you build
and
a life.
I think it also depends. I think it also depends on the culture and economics. I outside of writing, I do like to like look into like economics and stuff. And if you look actually historically, if you were already well off, if you were upper class or whatnot, you were going to get married younger because you already had the assets to take care of a new family. So, in some places, getting married young was actually a bit of a status, or having your children get married young was a bit of a status symbol because it's like, look, we already have all of this wealth that, we're not having to work until a certain age, and then we can have enough money to take care of a family. Whereas in a lot of cultures, if you were not wealthy or upper class, if you didn't have a lot of assets, then you worked into your mid-20s until you had enough money to take care of a family or enough land or whatever you needed. And that's why if you look into a lot of records in the past, the wealthy, the elite, their kids were getting married off. Marriages were arranged when they were teenagers in their early 20s. But if you were poorer, if you were working class, then often you would have individuals who'd be in their mid-20s before they would get married. And that was purely because of an economic, because of economic issues.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think we should let people go because it's for both of our listeners tuning in on Christmas Day. It's time to spend with family, so we'll go ahead and wrap it up. If for our listeners who want to hear our other conversation with author Laura Nelson, I'm going to schedule that for February 8th, which is the next one I see clear on the calendar, because I'm releasing every Thursday. And I did get a little bit ahead of myself in late November and early December and scheduled too many. And I'm going to have an extra two episodes this month on Mondays instead of Thursdays. And so February 8th. And remind us, where can we find you and where can we find your books on the web?
So my website is www.llnelsonauthor.com. Pretty much all of my social media, whether you're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, you name it, all the social media, it's all LL Nelson Author. And then my books are available pretty much on all the different distributors, Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, you name it. They're also available through libraries.
Okay, great. All right, well, thanks for joining us today. And I think I'll just close out with wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We'll catch you next time on
Merry Christmas, everyone.